Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is a very good friend of mine and of all of us, Blair Horner, the Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. This guy knows more about New York State politics than anybody. You can't pick up a major newspaper without seeing his name there. Welcome back, Blair.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so former Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver's conviction is overturned on appeal. Another sign New York won't get the ethics reform it deserves?
Well, I mean, there's two parts of this. One is what happens in the court case, right, with Silver. You know, the whole conviction is vacated by the Court of Appeals. The decision turned on a seemingly relatively minor legal issue, which is when both Silver and Skelos were convicted about a year plus ago, the court instructed the jury as to how to interpret federal law. They were both convicted under the federal bribery statute under the so-called theft of honest services. And when they instructed the jury on what the law meant, they used the law as it was interpreted at that time. And so the jury convicts both of them. Both of them are facing time in the orange jumpsuits at the Pokey. About a month or so after those decisions, a Supreme Court case came down which overturned a similar conviction against the Virginia governor, Bob McDonnell.
It's very important.
That's right. And the U.S. Supreme Court narrowed the scope of the federal bribery statute. And so Silver and Skelos have appealed, saying that the instructions to the jury were erroneous and therefore they should be freed men. And Silver won. Now, the opinion, the court goes out of its way to say, oh, by the way, you know, all the evidence is pretty substantial and, you know, you could be convicted on this stuff. On the other hand, the instructions to the jury were erroneous and a reasonable jury could have gotten the exact same evidence and decided that he was innocent. And so they said the decision's vacated. The acting U.S. attorney, June Kim, has said that he will retry the case.
Okay, now let's familiarize everybody in case a few people have forgotten what goes on here. The guts of this case were that there was a doctor, right?
Well, there's essentially two sort of big chunks of it. One is that Silver, in his capacity, in his outside job as a trial lawyer, working for a big firm that handled, among other things, cases of individuals injured by exposure to asbestos, that Silver had an arrangement with an outside expert, a doctor, I believe at Mount Sinai, who was
Columbia, I don't remember. It was one of those.
New York City hospitals. Yeah, he's considered the expert in mesothelioma treatments, and that the deal was, according to the court papers, is that Silver was driving government grants to this doctor. In exchange, the doctor was sending to Silver cases of people who had been exposed to asbestos who he thought would be good plaintiffs in lawsuits against the asbestos companies. And so that way, the theory was, in that particular case, that Silver was enriching himself and using government grants in his capacity as the top assembly Democrat to drive grants to this particular doctor, and he was getting effectively kickbacks through the doctors, sending clients. And now Silver never had to defend anybody or bring any cases, but he did get a finder's fee from this big law firm. So that was one sort of cluster.
But let me just say, you know, I mean, anecdotally, the kinds of things I've heard is the guy says, the doctor says to Silver, and I just want the other side present a little bit. The doctor says, thank you, Shelley, for the grants. And Shelley says, that's fine. Just send me some stuff. Just send me some send me some of your patients. So
that's boiling it down. That's effectively how it all worked out.
So, well, but there's a big difference, I think, between some kind of collusive plan in which Shelley Silver sets up this whole thing of driving the grants that he can get
I mean, there are nuances to this, but that's what he was convicted of.
That's the word I was looking for, nuances.
The nuance is this relationship in terms of the grants ended in 2010. Silver was brought up on charges in 2015. There's a statute of limitations issue of 5 years. So anyhow, it's a murky issue, but he was convicted on that count. The second cluster of issues was that Silver was using in his capacity as speaker, was benefiting big real estate developers, particularly Glenwood Management in New York City, which is one of the biggest real estate firms in the city of New York. And as a way to pay him back, business was being directed to a little-known law firm. Certainly no one knew that Silver was affiliated with it. And business was being driven to that particular firm that Silver enriched himself with. And he was using his power as assembly speaker to help out real estate developers. And so there's these two clusters of cases. He was convicted on all counts. And the court did not overturn any of the substantive convictions in the appeals. But it was on this technical issue of the instructions to the jury.
Right. Right.
So the prognosis for reform, you know, I mean, that was the second part of your question.
It was.
You know, I mean, it was on life support to begin with because the governor and the legislative leaders have shown no interest in doing anything. They've been sort of rhetorically, you know, saying things. But anytime any sort of serious reform proposal advanced, one of them would shoot it down and blame the other. So I don't think the fact that he is off the hook, at least temporarily, is going to hurt the effort for reform because the effort for reform is on life support to begin with. Whether or not they bury it in the ground, I think, is really the big issue. And there are other court cases that are sort of moving along through the process, which could add further fuel to the reform fire going into an election year for the governor and the legislature, which last year was not.
Of course, one wonders at this stage of the game, because of all the corruption that we read about and that we see in the legislature and the Congress, one wonders if a politician could go on trial and get anybody on a jury to vote for them.
You hope that's not the case. You hope what people focus on are the facts before them. And I'm certainly in no position to, you know if somebody's innocent or guilty. I'm not on any of the juries. But there have been now a number of convictions, dozens of elected officials that have gone off to the pokey, and others that are other public officials that are still in the docket that you would hope that voters would consider that when they go to the polls in a year from this November.
Now, Blair Horner of NYPIRG, I wanted to go from one set of trials to another, and the famous trials, the ones which everybody are sitting on spilkas, that means pins and needles, is to wait for the pals of Cuomo, POC, to go on trial for corruption, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
And just as we speak today, we're hearing that specific trial dates have been set and of a separation of a group of so-called people.
Yeah, I mean, there's another cluster of cases moving along. One deals specifically with a top aide to the governor and an associate of the governor, with regard basically to shaking down those seeking government contracts to enrich these individuals, as well as to shake them down for campaign contributions for the governor. It's a cluster around the Buffalo Billion economic development issue, and there's a top aide to the governor, former top aide to the governor, and an associate who are in that. The associate has already pled guilty. Then there's another cluster of cases around the former head of the Nano Center at SUNY, and again, the issue of bid rigging to enrich favored contractors there. Those cases were the indictments were brought against them collectively. The judge had set jury trials for the end of October of this year. She has now split them because she's also hearing these other cases with regard to Silver and Skelos. It's the same judge. And so she's moved the cases into next year and split them. So the cases dealing with the top aide, former aide to the governor and his associate and the relevant contractors starts in early January, and then a subsequent package around the Nano Center issues will start sometime in the late spring, summer of next year.
So that's the substance. Now let's talk the politics.
It's all bad politics if you're the governor.
If you're the governor, when you extend it into next year, he's got to run in 2018, it'll be pretty fresh. That trial will be fresh on people's minds, even though he is not a defendant.
No, right. And no one's alleged that I know of that there's anything that the governor was involved in. The questions really
were... Except bad judgment in appointing all these guys as his primary advisors.
Well, I mean, again, they're innocent until proven guilty, although one of them has pled guilty. But everyone's innocent until proven guilty, and it may turn out that they're all innocent, right? We don't know yet.
Well, the one who pled guilty isn't going to be innocent.
That's right. That's right. He, on the other hand, has a problem. And he is being a cooperating witness with the government.
That means he's singing like a canary.
And that means that it creates problems, certainly, for the other defendants in those cases. Yeah, I mean, at best, if it goes to trial, which we don't know, but if it goes to trial, at best, it presents an unsavory picture of how Albany operates, particularly with regard to the administration. I mean, here, again, there are independent, allegedly corrupt acts by these individuals to benefit themselves. But as part of the allegations, there's also that they were shaking down developers for campaign contributions to the governor. And that will raise the issue of how the campaign financing system works in the state of New York. It will raise how the governor has been able to amass a war chest of $25 million plus dollars now.
Well, yeah, I heard $25-27 million, right. something like that. But that's a lot of money,
yes,
for a governor who says he thinks that the influence of money in elections is too great.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the influences of a huge war chest is that you don't have a serious opponent. And so the governor's raising money hand over fist right now for his reelection effort. And here it is, about a year and a half out. He's easily going to be able to raise $50 million.
Sure.
And that should ward off anyone, you know, unless the person can self-finance, unless one of these trials lands a real knockout punch to the governor.
Well, now, we just looked at a series of polls that showed that the governor is losing a lot of popularity. What's that about, Blair Horner of NYPIRG?
Well, I mean, the governor's polling numbers had been actually inching up after the election of President Trump. And every governor gets a bump from the election of an opposing party in the presidency. His father did, George Pataki did. And where you normally run into problems is when someone of the same party gets elected to be president, because then your bully pulpit gets smaller, and the issues you're focusing on become smaller as well. In this case, the governor, I thought, had tried and reasonably successfully to juxtapose himself as someone who was going to take on the policies of the Republican Congress and the Republican president. Now, the problem with the governor is his support is downstate, his opposition is upstate. Downstate lives and breathes on a mass transit system working. And the mass transit system is not working appropriately. The governor's done everything he can to distance himself from the decisions that led to this
problem.
Too
late, because he also took credit when he opened up the Second Avenue subway.
That's right. Well, and when he shut it down for the storms and everything else. I mean, the governor can't run away from his responsibilities with the MTA. He can't paper it over. So the voters downstate, or at least seemingly at least as of now, are holding the governor at least partially responsible for the mess known as the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and their unhappiness with getting stuck with subways or Long Island Railroad trains that go out of service. All of that stuff is increasingly being directed at the governor, and that, I think, is causing his polling numbers to erode. Whether or not he can do anything about it, of course, is the next big question.
Well, if you're an Andrewologist, which I am, a follower of what
it's a new science, I heard.
Of Andrew's personality traits are, he's always trying to get more power for himself. Now, in this case, it may have backfired. In other words, he's always at war with de Blasio. He's always trying to take power away from de Blasio. He's always trying to take power away from the state and duties away from the state controller, Tom DiNapoli. And he's succeeded. He does name the most people on the MTA. And maybe this has come up to bite him in the keister.
Well, what he inherited at the MTA, that the structure of that system is an inherited structure. I mean, in terms of the contracting issue, which we just talked about before.
Sure.
Coincidentally with the allegations of corruption, is the same time when the governor was successful in pulling back the comptroller's authority to oversee government contracts. Now, whether or not they would have had any relationship, who knows? But it is at the same time. With the MTA, the governor has pledged to spend money, but has been very resistant to have that money earmarked for the mass transit system. And in fact, there have been recent media reports of him directing the MTA money, for example, to upstate ski slopes. And that's the kind of stuff that the public gets. They understand when you're using subway money for upstate ski slopes, they know that it's not that's not for them. Meanwhile, they're in the subway that's stuck between stations, and they blame the governor, rightly
or wrongly. For 2.5 hours sweating there.
Yeah, I know.
But what happened? I mean, you know, I'm an inveterate subway user when I got to New York. I love the subways. You get on at 86th Street, you get down at the Lincoln Center, takes a few seconds to get there. All of a sudden, all hell's broken loose. Do we know what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is just deferred maintenance, that when you're not investing, it's a lot easier to invest your money in new things, like the Second Avenue subway and be there for the ribbon cutting than it is to focus your money on ongoing maintenance for a 100-year-old system. And you see, I mean, politicians are, you know, susceptible to this malady all the time, where they'd rather cut ribbons for new bridges and then spend money on fixing potholes because no one really cares. They just want the potholes fixed. You can't really cut a ribbon for that. And my guess is, to some extent, there has been a de-emphasis on making sure that the 100-year-old system is operating properly and a re-emphasis on new bridges, for the Kosciuszko Bridge in Brooklyn, for example, the Gothels Bridge in Staten Island. They're all being renovated. There's been this new Second Avenue subway. I mean, that all costs a lot of money, and if you're tying your money up in those projects, you may not be focusing your money in the sort of maintenance stuff.
Speaking of bridges, one of the interesting things that came out of this last round of polling is that New Yorkers aren't real happy about naming the Tappan Zee Bridge, renaming it from Malcolm Wilson, to Mario Cuomo. And that's interesting. I love Mario Cuomo, of course, had a program with him for many years. But what's that about?
Yeah, it seemingly came out of nowhere at the end of session. There was certainly no public debate over what should be the name of the new Tappan Zee Bridge, which everyone will call, I assume, the Tappan Zee Bridge, in the same way as they called the Malcolm Wilson Bridge the Tappan Zee Bridge. Nevertheless, it came up at the last minute. It appeared to be part of the horse trading to wrap up the end of session. There's going to be a renaming, I think, of Riverside Park to be named after Denny Farrell. And there was some other issues that came up. And it got sort of thrown into the mix as a way to sort of close down the end of session. I think the public probably views it as a little too close to the current governor's name. And they don't like, the public doesn't like when those kinds of things happen. It makes them feel like it's just horse trading and not on the substance. But again, you know, Mario Cuomo did do a lot of spending on this state's highways and bridges and subways. And so he certainly, you can make an argument that in modern times, he probably has more to do with the existing infrastructure of the state of New York than Malcolm Wilson does.
You know, NYPIRG, New York Public Interest Research Group, which has a lot of students in it, is very lucky. I know that you're going to be embarrassed by this, to have you as their leader. And one of the things that you have a real interest in, that a lot of young people who tend to support NYPIRG do, is in the environment. And I see you've written an article about the world gets a huge new iceberg.
Right.
What's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, your listeners, I'm sure, should be well aware,
sure,
that there was a huge part of Antarctica, the ice sheet of Antarctica, that fell off recently and floated away into the sea. It's about 6,000 kilometers in size, which is roughly the size of the state of Delaware, and the first state, actually. And this gigantic iceberg, maybe the biggest iceberg ever, certainly the collapses off Antarctica. And there's some debate over how much of that you can attribute to climate change and how much you can't. But the idea that the geography of Antarctica is changing due to global warming is not a scientific debate. And the whole issue of, you know, what are we going to do about a planet where global warming is increasingly a runaway problem is a legitimate issue for this generation and for future generations. The carbon dioxide levels now are reaching levels that have not been seen since prehistoric times, millions of years ago. And that's going to have an impact, a devastating impact on the planet. And the worst part about it, in my opinion, is that the people who are going to suffer the most are the people from countries that had the least to do with it. So Micronesia, Bangladesh, those people are going to suffer horrible consequences from runaway global warming, while the more affluent countries, the poorest and the most affluent countries, may suffer, but those countries are the best situated to sort of deal with it. And again, we don't even know what's going to happen. The worst part is the fact that the President of the United States and the Congress seem to not only be not interested in this looming environmental catastrophe, but are in fact doing everything they can to undermine what little steps have been taken to deal with it. And shame on them. Millions of people will suffer. Many will die because of the idiotic policies of the Congress and the President of the United States in this area. And you hope that ultimately they'll follow the science and do the right thing, and maybe we can avert the worst of the consequences.
Blair Horner, I only have a couple of minutes now, but I want to go on two subjects. One, very quickly, because it just tickles my fancy, and that is that Bill Raffogel, William Raffogel, is out of jail. Explain to everybody who he is and take at least a minute to do it in.
At least a minute. Well, I'll do what I can. William Raffogel is the head of a prominent, or formerly was the head of a very prominent Jewish philanthropic organization in New York City that did a lot of work on housing issues. He was convicted of
being a thief,
of accepting kickbacks and stealing from the charity that he headed. He is very close with the former Speaker of the Assembly, Sheldon Silver,
right,
and in fact the husband of the former Speaker's now former Chief of Staff, Judy Raffogel.
A lot of formers.
Yes. And U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara sort of cleared the deck when it came down to these power brokers. So he's out. He served his time in prison.
But he went very quietly. I mean, this is the way they do it around here. You know, somebody pleads guilty. They get into trouble. They plead guilty. There's sort of a wink and a nod, and they go in, and they're out for good behavior in no time. Meanwhile, some kid walks in with a bandana over his nose and gets 10 years of prison.
No, that's right. I mean, the justice system does have its flaws, and one of them is the way that powerful powerful people get treated for white-collar crimes as compared to not-so-powerful people get treated for often petty crimes. You're right, but Raffogel did, pay his debt to society.
Does Eric Schneiderman have the guts to run against Andrew Cuomo in a primary?
I don't know what, who knows what the future holds for any of these guys. But, I mean, they're of the same political party. They're both entrenched incumbents. They both are raising a lot of money for their reelection efforts. They both are allowed to receive huge campaign contributions. How politicians chart their political course is often, sort of influenced more than anything by the prevailing political winds. And we don't know a year out what those winds are going to look like.
And my friend Jerry Benjamin is going to be interested in this question. It does appear from the last polling data that has just flown by that fewer and fewer New Yorkers have any faith in a constitutional convention. What do you make of that?
Well, and the vast majority of people have no clue as to what it is.
That's correct.
So the people that know something about it, the support of it is a little more eroding. I think part of it stems from, as those few people become educated on how the process will work, I think there's some concern that the people who would be elected would be the same people who run the state now. But we'll see.
So I got one more minute on this. Andrew Cuomo has announced he's taking on the Republicans who are part of our congressional delegation in New York. You know, John Faso, Elise Stefanik, people like that. The only one he's leaving alone is Peter King out there in Long Island, I suspect, because he can't win. He can't beat him. So does he have a chance of eliminating these people?
Yeah, I mean, at one point, New York had virtually all of its congressional delegation as Democrats. 2018 will be in many ways a referendum on President Trump and his policies, as well as the Congress. And a lot of these members had to walk the plank on the repeal of Obamacare, which at least at the moment appears to have collapsed, and taken a vote where they were going to strip away from everyday Americans, millions of everyday Americans, their health insurance, which is, it's almost unconscionable that they could even consider such a thing. But that's what they did. And many of them walked with the House leadership and voted that way. And they're going to have to explain that vote to their constituents.
Only to have Trump turn around and say it was a mean bill.
Well, and it did, and the whole thing collapsed anyway. Yeah. It may not even happen by the time they're up for re-election. And they still have to be stuck with the vote.
So the way that it's shaping up right now is that Donald Trump may be one of the most unpopular people in New York State that ever was, almost like Chris Christie across the Hudson. Is it your sense that Trump will control what happens in our elections?
Well, I mean, Trump is going to be, the way it looks a year out, right, is going to be it'll be a referendum on the president of the United States. And that's the way the elections of 2018 are shaping up, at least as you look at it from 2017. Although, as we know, and certainly in a year's time, anything can happen. But the way it's set up right now, I mean, the president has done a very good job of making everything that happens in the country about him. And that means the election will be about him.
Always great to talk to Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Blair, we always love having you here, especially in the middle of the summer. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.